starting 6 centuries ago, the Western male elite has built a viciously patriarchal world by making war on women and exploiting them mercilessly. The profits of the global capitalist system have been made possible by the genocide and plunder of women.
This documentary is about how women have been colonized by men and the many ways in which they resist this.
You're listening to Women, the Oppressed Majority, a three-part radio documentary series. I'm Kristen Schwartz.
I'm Asad Ismi. This is Endless Exploitation, the second episode in our series. For the next half hour, we focus on Bangladesh, Nepal, Canada, and the United States, and show how women create most of the world's wealth, which is stolen from them by a small male elite.
As feminist author Maria Mies explains, quote, "Women, not men, are the optimal labor force for the capitalist accumulation process on a world scale," unquote. Women do 66% of the world's work and produce 50% of its food, but make only 10% of its income and own a mere 1% of property. Valuable housework and crucial child rearing done by women are not only uncompensated, they are not even recognized as work. Unpaid work done by women amounts to an astounding $11 trillion. Women and girls constitute 60% of the world's poorest people and two-thirds of those who are illiterate. Only 19% of national parliamentarians are women. It is by exploiting women and the poor majority in the global south to such an extreme that capitalism accumulates massive wealth for a small number of men.
Presently, the most horrendous form of exploitation of women by men is sex trafficking, which has reached its highest level ever. Global sex trafficking and sexual slavery are driven by the generation of enormous profits for men who lure women and girls within and across borders with false promises of jobs and then force them into unpaid prostitution. Sex trafficking is the fastest growing criminal enterprise in the world, with about 4.5 million women and children bought and sold into sexual slavery. These females are mainly taken from poor countries of the global south and Eastern Europe to Western Europe, the US, and Canada.
Sex trafficking constitutes 79% of human trafficking, which generates $32 billion in profits every year, making it the third biggest income earner for organized crime after drugs and arms sales. In Canada, traffickers can earn an average of $280,000 annually from every female victim. After being trafficked, women are forced to have sex with as many as 50 men a day and give the male pimp all their money. If the woman does not earn the demanded amount of money, she's often punished with electric shocks and severe beatings. The women are also starved, branded, and injected with heroin.
With 27 million people, the impoverished country of Nepal borders India and is a prominent target of sex trafficking. 16,000 Nepali women and girls are trafficked every year, mainly to brothels in India, while 7,500 children are trafficked inside Nepal for sexual exploitation. Nepali women and girls are also trafficked to the Middle East, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and South Korea for sexual slavery. Anuradha Koirala is founder and director of Methi Nepal, a non-profit organization that rescues and rehabilitates victims of sex trafficking. Methi has saved 25,000 girls from sex trafficking and got convictions against 1,200 traffickers, resulting in their jailing, according to Koirala. Koirala was invited to Toronto by Aura Freedom International to speak about Methi Nepal.
Now, at present moment, the situation of trafficking in Nepal is a little different. Yeah? It used to be cross-border. It is now overseas. Our girls are going as far as Tanzania, Nigeria, Kenya, Nairobi, Kyrgyzstan, Lebanon, and Kuwait and Qatar is very common in search of job. Now when they come back, the situation is again different. From India, they are pushed back when they are sick, ill, like when they are HIV positive. But in the Middle East, the girls, when they come back, it's not with HIV. They come 80% of them come with mental disorder because they are taken there in the name of job. But there, they are sexually exploited. In a room like this in India, there would be about 200 beds, yeah, bunk beds, and you have to serve a man, serve people, the clients. But in Middle East, they would give you this big room for one person, but the job would be the same. The master, the master's friend, friend's friend, son's friend, son, everybody. So she would have to serve at least about 10 to 15 men per day. And in India, from 5 to 35 per day. So that is the difference. And then these girls who go to the Middle East, their passport is taken and torn into pieces, and they are called hudun. Hudun means illegal. And like, if even if they want to run away, now they don't have a passport. And they don't know where to go, how to reach our embassy. So that is why they get mentally sick and they're back. And many times, they're even tortured, they're beaten, their backs are broken. We had a girl whose whole, she was paralyzed whole under the hip, under the waist. She was all gone. She couldn't walk.
Koirala gives the example of Radhika, a young Nepalese woman sold into sexual slavery in India by her own husband. Along with Radhika, her husband also sold their 2-year-old son, Rohan, into slavery. Rohan's tongue was burnt by his captors to keep him quiet so he would not interfere with the sex that his mother was forced to perform.
After 6 years, we rescued Radhika and Rohan together. And now Rohan and Radhika is back. Rohan is still traumatized. He cannot speak properly because of the burn in his tongue. And Radhika is doing very well. She is looking after the whole garden in Maithi, Nepal. That is how she is reintegrated, because when she came back, the first thing we did was we apprehended her trafficker, her husband. And then we went to the court, and now he is in the jail for 15 years. He is in the jail for 15 years.
Koirala believes that gender discrimination, not poverty, is the main cause of sex trafficking in Nepal.
Everybody in the world says, yeah, because we are our country is a developing country, right? So they all say that we are poor, that is why the girls, Nepali girls, are trafficked, yeah? But I don't see that, yeah? Because it is gender discrimination first, yeah? Poverty is one of the causes, but gender discrimination is the main cause, yeah? Because the government says education is free for girls, right? It is not free. We have to pay, in the government schools, I'm talking about private schools, you have to pay lots of money. But government schools, you have to pay more than 3,000-4,000 rupees, yeah? And then parents would say, why should I send the girl to school? She will get married and go to someone else's house. I will educate the boys. So here we are, discriminated in education. Then for job, yeah? Boys are giving priority for jobs. Women are not given. So these are the causes of gender discrimination, I think.
Unfortunately, sex trafficking is often used as an excuse by some Western governments to crack down on prostitution. Sex work is legitimate work, and its criminalization actually encourages the spread of sex trafficking by increasing the profits of traffickers, marginalizing sex workers, and driving them underground, where their exploitation becomes easier. In contrast, decriminalizing sex work reduces sex trafficking.
The state of New South Wales in Australia decriminalized sex work in 1995, and a 2012 study found no evidence of recent trafficking of female sex workers. New Zealand legalized prostitution in 2003 with similar positive results. A United Nations commission has pointed out that decriminalization of sex work is an effective way to reduce exploitation in the sex industry. The UN-backed Global Commission on HIV and the Law has called for the legalization of prostitution worldwide. The UN's International Labour Organization recommends the same.
Chanel Gallant describes herself as part of queer, feminist, and sex working communities. She has represented Maggie's, the Toronto Sex Workers Action Project.
In 2003, sex workers themselves, and not some saviors, developed the New Zealand model of decriminalization that explicitly included labor protections for sex workers. The New Zealand model prioritizes human rights and health and safety. It's supported by sex worker groups, women's groups, YMCAs, and Indigenous groups in New Zealand. Workers there report feeling safer and being able to exercise more control over their work, including street work. And that has meant that in the 10 years following the introduction of the law, there was not one reported case of trafficking. This approach actually works. I also just want to mention that the MP who proposed this law was a Maori woman and former sex worker, Georgina Bayer. And I say that because I want to lift up how much of this work is being done by Indigenous women.
The New Zealand model has not been adopted in Canada. Gallant explains that this is because Canadian laws that prohibit sex work are deeply rooted in colonialism.
So we have the solutions. We know what works. We have the research on it. Why isn't this model being introduced? We know that it makes workers safer, it's better for public health, it's better for HIV prevention, it reduces trafficking. Why wouldn't everybody be jumping on this? Well, it was in the work of Anishinaabe scholar Naomi Sayers that I learned that the first anti-sex work laws in Canada were in the Indian Act. Her research points out how sex work laws were introduced in Canada as a way of controlling Indigenous people, women in particular, and was part of attempts by European settlers to destroy women's autonomy over their bodies and get access to land and resources.
Bangladesh is the second largest garment exporter worldwide. More than 85% of garment workers in Bangladesh are women, and they are the lowest paid in the world. The exploitation of women workers by male factory owners in the country is even worse than this. 1,100 workers were killed in the 2013 Rana Plaza disaster when this factory building in Dhaka, Bangladesh's capital, collapsed. This was the worst disaster in the global garment sector.
Kalpana Akhtar is executive director of the Bangladesh Center for Worker Solidarity in Dhaka. The center conducts labor rights and leadership training for garment workers in Bangladesh and helps them organize unions. Akhtar was invited by progressive Canadian unions to undertake a speaking tour aimed at raising awareness about the Rana Plaza tragedy. She herself became a garment worker at the age of 12 to support her family and was fired when she was 18 for trying to organize a union. She was also blacklisted, which means that no garment factory would give her a job.
That you can say, of course, the garment industry, you know, it is like based on the exploitation of women because they are paying low wage or poverty wage to the workers. No health and safety. These are unsafe death trap factories and no union voice. The other factors are there is a huge verbal abuse. Sometimes it is physical too. And, the female workers, there is some certain benefits for workers like maternity leave with benefit, daycare centers. The women workers at the factory cannot enjoy this facility. And there is an excessive production target for these female workers. So this is another exploitation too. And other one in terms of the promotions, you know, to promote them to operator, to supervisors. So most of the time this promotion gets by the male worker rather than the female. So this is another kind of exploitation too.
The average wage for female garment workers in Bangladesh is $68 a month, which is a poverty wage.
Within this money, one person, you know, it is difficult for one person to live, and they have, you know, four or five members in the family, almost everyone. So it's miserable. I mean, these companies has given them a job, but in the same time, they made them ultra poor.
Very few workers in Bangladesh's garment industry are organized, and helping union organizing, which is part of Akhtar's work, is a dangerous task. Her co-organizer has been murdered for this work, and she herself has suffered torture and imprisonment.
Example, my colleague Aminul Islam has been, you know, murdered. He kidnapped and severely tortured, brutally tortured and beaten to death. And because he was a union organizer, he was my colleague. I know him like for 8 years or so. He was a senior organizer at our center, as well as a regional president for one union. So he has been killed. So that is an example. And supporting workers' voice and organizing them, and supporting workers' voice to raising the minimum wage. I was in prison. There is a different 11 criminal charges brought against us. I was put in jail, psychologically tortured, interrogated even 18 hours in a row.
Many Western companies get clothes made in Bangladesh and so are responsible for and benefit from the extreme exploitation of its women garment workers.
I mean, these companies are, you know, responsible for the killing, I should say, killing of, thousands of Bangladeshi workers. All the Western companies, if I name them, they can be Walmart, Gap, JCPenney, Sears, Hudson Bay, Loblaw, you know, everyone, H&M, everyone, all of them taking, advantage out of it or making profit out of these human phases.
The profits of Western corporations are based not only on the horrendous exploitation of women workers in Bangladesh and other countries of the global south, but also on the similar exploitation of women living in the West itself. In the last two decades, wages have fallen massively in the United States and Canada, with the disappearance of millions of well-paying manufacturing jobs and the enormous growth of low-paid, part-time, temporary, and unstable work, much of it done by women. Just as Western companies have subcontracted the making of garments to Bangladeshi women, they have also subcontracted out work in many sectors inside the West, mainly to women. These sectors include retail, the health field, agriculture, and office work.
Dina Ladd is coordinator of the Workers' Action Center in Toronto and has organized for more than 20 years to protect and promote the rights of women and men in low-wage and precarious work.
Well, I think what we've seen in the healthcare system is very typical that we've seen in with large corporations actually shedding their responsibility for their workforce. So, for instance, what we're seeing in hospitals is the subcontracting out of cleaning, the subcontracting out of cafeteria work, of maintenance work. Again, all of the work traditionally done by racialized women. And then what we've seen is the contracting out of healthcare services to the community. This was supposed to be a good thing for the community, services moving from hospitals and decentralized. But again, what you've seen there is a bidding process for agencies to provide personal support work and other healthcare services to the local community, having to bid against each other for contracts, and where you actually have the government has allowed for-profit agencies to bid against non-for-profit agencies. And so then what that has meant is that the lowest bidder gets the contract. And how are they able to afford that? Well, it's on labor costs, right? And so what we see is, so women who go to people's homes, the elderly, the sick, people who have all kinds of healthcare issues, women are visiting them at home as personal support workers, not paid for their travel time, not paid for the wait time between clients, not paid if their clients cancel, not protected if their clients are violent or abusive, not paid for sick days. So all of the costs are borne by that individual woman. That is hard, hard day's work. So I know women who work 12 hours a day. They're out of their house early, don't come back until late, but they're technically only paid for 7 hours of that time. And so that is a typical example of how it's working in healthcare, but how that has also happened in other sectors.
Shockingly, in much of Ontario, which is Canada's biggest province, half the workers are in low-wage work. Almost all of these workers are non-unionized and often paid minimum wage without benefits.
Studies that have come out that have looked at the sort of rise of precarious employment, and even in the Greater Toronto Area and the southwestern Ontario area, we see 50% of workers in precarious work, right? I mean, that's staggering, right? Again, another research report showed that the lower your income, the less likelihood you are to have drug and dental benefits. So we know, in addition to crappy wages, people's health is really suffering, and people are not able to fill out their prescriptions for the medication that they need, because it literally is a choice between paying the rent and filling out their script, and the script goes by the wayside. And so we have workers who are dealing with very stressful jobs, with very precarious work, with very unstable wages and schedules, that are shifting from day to day, week to week. People don't know if they're going to pay their bills. And then in addition to that, if you have children, how the hell are you supposed to find childcare for your kids when your shift is changing from day to day and you don't know until 6 o'clock that morning whether you have a job that day? And then in addition to that, you can't even get your medication for any of the issues that you might have to deal with. That is a prescription for a nightmare. And that's what we see for many of our members, is that, you know, the littlest health issue can send people over the edge, because they actually have there's nothing to give. There's nothing, there's no leeway, there's no safety net, there's no little slush fund. People are used up from paycheck to paycheck and massively in debt.
Almost 60% of Canadians and 62% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck.
I mean, it sounds all doom and gloom, but it really is. I mean, I think it has been like that for a long time.
Not only does the Western capitalist system maximize its profits globally by paying women very little, it also does not recognize crucial parts of women's work as work that should be paid for at all. This includes women giving birth to the entire world's labor force, which is clearly the bedrock of all economies, as well as the critical bringing up of children and the important housework associated with the creation of family life. Selma James is the founder of the International Wages for Housework campaign and coordinator of the Global Women's Strike Organization. She wrote the women's movement classic book titled The Power of Women and the Subversion of the Community.
As more and more women have to go out to work in industrial societies, less and less caring goes on, and we feel the impact in the children, in the adults, in the elderly, because we lack the attention and love and care that we need to be not only for survival in the physical sense, but survival in the sense of the pursuit of happiness. We cannot be happy without caring for each other. It is the basis of all life, not only human life. Every animal that we know about survives because of the love of the mother. It is a law of nature, and it's our nature, except that we as human beings, we expect it not only from the mother, but also from the father. We expect all humans to care. But we have a society which undermines every attempt for us to care for each other.
For James, the women's struggle against male domination is a struggle against capitalism and its class system, which pays women less than men in order to pit the genders against each other so it can control societies more easily through divide and rule tactics.
Class and sexism go together. Sexism is a strategy of the ruling class. They pay us less. Where does the money go? It doesn't go to men. It goes to them. They pay mothers the least of all the women. Who gets the benefit? Not the men, not the fathers, the 1%. So that the strategy of sexism in the division of labor and the division of wages is part and parcel of exploitation, in the sense that men are trained to go out to work to bring money and to be in charge as a result, because they have the money in their pockets and we women have less or none, frankly. And that is what the dominant class wants, promotes, and in fact needs. You know, it's very important to them, to the few on top, and there aren't really many. 1% is a generous proportion of the society. They want women and men to be against each other and for men to be in charge of women on their behalf, on behalf of the 1%.
So it is a anti-capitalist struggle. When we struggle against male domination, it is also anti-capitalist struggle against a class system.
Absolutely. You put it exactly as I would. That means that the 1% are trying to keep us divided and therefore weak and concentrating on ourselves at the expense of others. But we really become ourselves with others. We are not ourselves until we are with others.
You've been listening to Endless Exploitation, the second episode of the documentary series, Women, the Oppressed Majority.
Women, the Oppressed Majority is dedicated to the memory of Queen Nzinga, ruler of the nation of Ndongo, known as Angola today. She successfully resisted Portuguese colonialism and slavery for 40 years, from 1624 to 1664.
This documentary was written by Asad Ismi and produced by Kristen Schwartz. It was written in 2015 and produced in 2016. Go to www.asadismi.info to download the series. That's www.asadismi.info.
Theme music at the start of each episode is Tracy Thorn, Get Around to It. And at the end is a cover version of the Eurythmics' Sweet Dreams Are Made of This, sung by Emily Browning. This episode also featured the song My Heart is Broken by Evanescence, which is about sex trafficking.
This documentary was funded by Canadian Union of Postal Workers National, Public Service Alliance of Canada, Ontario Public Service Employees Union, Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, Canadian Union of Public Employees, QP Local 3903, QP Local 4400, Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association, Canadian Labour Congress, Ed Finn, Don Schmidt.
Thank you for listening.